This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Colin Pryor is one of Scotland's most wheel-kent landscape photographers. If you've seen a photograph of Scotland, chances are it's one of his. He's an extraordinary talent. It's his interest and his passion for the natural world, however, which has taken him all over the world to photograph wild places. In his latest project, Fragile, he turns his attention to birds' eggs, specifically the collection of birds' eggs at the National Museums of Scotland. The resulting book is beautiful and, I have to say, strangely mesmeric. I went along to the Collection Centre at the National Museums in Edinburgh to meet Colin and also Bob McGowan, the senior curator, who helped him pull the whole thing off. I began with Bob, who just explains a bit here about the collection.
The tray in front of you is a display case of blackbird clutches, which shows an incredible range of variation between the clutches for a single species. The egg collection here is about 47,000 clutches. It may sound like a lot, but it was collected over a 200-year period.
Now, a clutch is all the eggs that were in the nest at any one given time?
It's all the eggs from a single laying.
For some reason, collections of bird eggs have got something of... It's not a bad reputation in the public perception, but folk aren't comfortable with it.
No, you're absolutely right. I think there is definitely a very strong stigma against them, which has been built up over the years. I think this goes back to the first half of last century, when it was generally perceived that egg collecting was done by amateurs and that there was no real scientific validity in what they were doing.
The eggs that we're looking at here, the blackbird's eggs, there's some clutches of six, some clutches of four. What is astonishing about these, you know, and I'll bring you into this, Colin, because you've got a better eye for colour than I do, just the incredible variety. I mean, just the difference amongst all these eggs.
It's quite amazing. And you know, blackbird's eggs aren't the most beautiful, but you can see the variation that exists in this cabinet in front of us. I mean, some are red and pink, and others are turquoise. I mean, there's one clutch that looks like a starling's clutch. They're really pale blue, quite incredible. This is what I discovered with Bob's help in the museum. It was just the diversity, even within one clutch. You would search through trying to find the best example, which I wanted to photograph. And with some clutches, such as corn buntings, it was quite impossible just to select one egg of that species because they were so beautiful. It's just the innate beauty, and it's this temporal beauty, because obviously if it had been hatched, you know, the eggshell, then the calcium within that eggshell is absorbed into the bird. And what we see in front of us are obviously the shells, only the shells of these eggs, but some of them are exquisite.
Tell me the premise behind it. I mean, you've had this idea for a long, long time.
I have, and I've spent a large part of my working career in the Scottish landscape shooting wide panoramas, and I got to about 2010 and felt that I'd really said what I wanted to say about Scotland's landscape with that format, and I began to think about how I could interpret the landscape in another way with a story that was underpinned with some sort of environmental aspect, and I came upon the idea of photographing birds' eggs because I realised that they were beautiful and that three generations haven't seen birds' eggs. Nobody really is aware of the beauty that exists in them. And my idea was to photograph the eggs as I did in situ in the museum with Bob's help. And the other aspect was to create a landscape photograph of the habitat and create a diptych in the book, two disparate images but that were connected on so many different levels.
If I just open this out, first few pages, that, my favourite hill, Sylvan. I don't know whether that was sunrise or sunset, but I mean, you've got the whole thing basically just glowing the glorious russet colour. And beside that, a Merlin's egg. And I don't know how you feel about this, Bob, but I've looked at this book and looked at this book and looked at this book, and I cannot work out what makes it quite so hypnotic. Every time I look at an egg, I spot something else in it.
Well, it's quite interesting because it was only when Colin started his project that it made me look at eggs in a way that I hadn't really looked at them before either. I've generally seen them as scientific specimens that are accompanied by data, but I know that when Colin was scrutinising the colours and the patterns on them, that made me look at them far more closely as well. And I did have a rough idea about what he was trying to achieve, but I do remember the day when he took me up to the end of the bench, when he had printed out the first egg that he had photographed in conjunction with the habitat, and I was astounded at what he had managed to achieve. I mean, I knew what he was trying to do, but it surpassed my expectations.
I really wanted to photograph them in a way that allowed you to examine them. I mean, many of them are like planets.
it's like Mars, that one, the Merlin.
Well, that's what we saw. And, you know, we were at the other end of this lamp here, and we were using a process called stacking. Uh-huh. So it's almost like a CT scan. Most of the photographs on the egg of the eggs in the book are anything between 40 and 80 photographs of the same egg. All the images are then loaded into a specialist piece of software, and it blends them together so that you've got one egg that's sharp.
Pinch sharp and focus all the way through.
Yeah, front from the top, because if you take a camera lens and focus it on the top of the egg, the edges of the egg will still be unsharp because of the depth of field. You can't get sufficient depth of field. So the only way to overcome that is by taking multiple photographs and stacking them together. And that way, when you look at the egg, it just looks the way it does to your eye. Mm-hmm. As we photographed these eggs, we had a big 30-inch screen, and we were looking at the eggs at 100% magnification. And it was a bit like I'm old enough to remember the lunar module landing on the moon.
Me too.
And it was it was just, you know, each time the equipment takes a photograph, you just get a little micron or two closer and closer, and it was like moving across the surface of a planet.
That is extraordinary. What did you balance the camera on? Because I mean you're probably not talking a 25-pound tripod from somewhere.
We brought in a Cambo tripod. It's a studio tripod that weighs about 200 kilos, because in order to support all this equipment that was above a very fragile egg, rigidly, we needed to have all this equipment. And it took some time to prove the lighting, you know, and I knew that I couldn't come here and start, you know, experimenting with lighting methodology. Bob's time is precious, so I needed to come here and get through the egg photography. So I set up all this equipment in my own studio at home, and I worked out what the lighting would be, and I've got a very diffused lighting on the egg so that you can see just the beauty on the egg. I mean, there is a wee bit of fall off on the right hand side, which was quite deliberate, but it's not enough. The shadow's not killing the detail on the right hand side. And it was that colour, it was the pattern, and it's also the shape that make eggs so fascinating.
Bob, how did you react when Colin approached you in the first place? Because, I mean, you took 200 kilograms of equipment balanced over something quite so fragile.
I was quite enthusiastic about the idea because usually most of the visitors that we'd have, the research visitors, are doing it from an academic point of view. They're coming in to do research on the egg collection. And this really was a project which would straddle science and art, if you like. And it sounded like a very worthwhile project, which would hopefully open other people's eyes to the interest that bird egg collections have.
Where are the eggs in this room that we're standing in at the moment?
Varnished cabinets, these modules directly behind me, these were more recently acquired. When I say more recently, over the past 40 years, these are generally private egg collections that have been either donated or bequeathed to the museum.
So would all of these predate, what was the 1981 Wildlife and Countryside Act?
Most of them would predate it, but some of them don't, but the museum's licensed to hold eggs.
And when you talk about the records that come with these eggs, what do the records look like?
In the simplest form of them, they'd be usually small data cards which tell you the species name, the date of collection, the number of eggs in the clutch, the identity. They would usually say that they would identify it by seeing the bird on the nest, something on the incubation, usually fresh because they're easier to blow when they were fresh, the exact locality, and then other ancillary notes that might be quite relevant here. This one, for example, says the nest was in nettles in the corner of a rough field. The clutch was collected on the 14th of May, 1947. So these would be basic collections, but other people would have include measurements, photographs.
When was that photograph taken?
This was 25th of April 1942. Other collectors who were generally licensed, they went abroad, and one individual in particular travelled extensively throughout Europe from 1919 to the mid-1970s. And he built up an egg collection, and he was interested in subspecies of birds that were British breeding species, but it was the continental races that he was interested in. And he typed up diaries, he took his own photographs, printed out the photographs, and bound everything together. And they're fantastic. Scientific quality is very, very high, but also there's a vast amount of sociologically interesting material in the diaries as well.
How useful are these eggs as a collection scientifically?
They're very useful because they become part of a very long time series. I mean, most egg collections, they probably throughout the world, probably go back to just over 200 years. So the oldest ones were collected 200 years ago. I know that in our collection, we have two clutches which date from 1790. In the early part of last century, it wasn't really seen as if they had much scientific merit. But now, looking back on it, all of the clutches, they fill gaps either in space or time. And so if anyone's studying particular species or changes through time, every single clutch does have value.
Why were they seen as not having value? Because this was an amateur activity?
Largely because it was amateur, and people felt, well, there's enough. You know, there was enough eggs in museum collections, for example. But at that time, people were really just looking at, they would measure them, they would have the egg dimensions, perhaps the weight of the eggs, and then a description of what the eggs looked like. Whereas now, there's far more work can be done on them. There's chemical analysis of stable isotopes. Imaging can be done on them to look at the patterns on the eggs, things that the original collectors could have no foresight that the eggs could be used in these new ways that they can now.
Just the sheer beauty of them. Again, Northern Raven. I find myself looking at these things are almost like exercises in meditation. Because you look at it and you think, is that a rune? Is it signed? They're almost like signatures.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a petroglyph that's in that raven's egg there. I was trying to isolate, you know, the eggs that had, you know, the strongest pattern, but at the same time were representative of that species, because often you can find, as you can see here, I mean, that's not representative. These four light blue blackbird's eggs with no speckling on isn't representative of blackbirds in general, but with the smaller species of birds. their eggs are obviously much, much smaller. And it takes quite a long time to go through a cabinet where you've got maybe 18 clutches that have got four or five eggs each in them. So there's 180 eggs there that you've got to really go through. And it's quite strange. Often you find one clutch and there's maybe three eggs in that one clutch that are exquisitely marked, whereas other clutches aren't quite as strong. So it's a bit of a subtractive process. You've got to say, is that better than that? And you've got to make these decisions. And that actually takes quite a lot of time, you know, that searching for the marked eggs. And some species, as I mentioned earlier, the corn buntings in particular, or reed buntings, it's almost like hand-painted art that's on the eggs. It's incredible.
Interesting you should say that, because I think it might have been the Dunlin. But, you know, there are marks in the Dunlin. I looked at it and I thought, oh, you know, that reminds me of something. It reminds me of an artist. And I turned the page and there was a quote from Joan Miro. I thought, that's the one.
But that egg of the reed bunting, that particular egg, it's got the hallmarks of Miro's artwork on
yes,
there.
Right.
And when I saw that, I thought, I've got to find a quote from Miro, because this is, they're exquisite, absolutely exquisite. What drove the selection of the habitat was the dominant colour of the egg. So all the habitats that I photographed are bona fide habitats, but often I might need to go back in a different season, and that different season might have been the following year or the year after. I mean, we've just had a very mediocre autumn, for instance, and it was 3 and 4 years ago that we had autumns that were quite memorable, but we haven't had one, certainly from photography of forests and so forth. It's not been great since.
Yeah, oh, that was a question I was going to ask you. Pardon the pun, a chicken and egg situation. did you pick the egg first and then think, right, which, you know, what do I need to have to actually match this? Or were you picking the eggs thinking, I've got this in stock already?
No, there were some images that I had, because even before I started photographing the eggs, and I knew I would find a way eventually to do this. From 2010 on, I was visiting locations where I'd spotted places that are undisturbed. And when I was doing a lot of the mountain photography, you're always really on a watch, you know, whether you're going to camp up there or you've got to be there for a certain time. But over that period of 30 years, I made these mental notes about forests or areas where I knew there was photographic potential, but not necessarily for panoramic images, but there were places I wanted to go back to, and this book really is the fruition of the return to many of these habitats. That there, I didn't know at the time would be for a raven, but there was a synergy when I photographed the raven's eggs. There are ravens round the top of the buckle there.
Yeah, well, it's a buckle out of more. It would have taken me a while to recognise it. It really would, because it's basically just keeking out a cloud and no more.
But it looks
ideal for ravens.
Oh, perfect. It breaks that cliche of the Buccellata of Moher image. It looks like something from the Karakoram Mountains.
Yes.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, even the Latin name of the raven, was it Corvus corax?
Yeah.
Corax. I mean, it's, you know, that you can hear that bouncing off a rock wall somewhere. It's onomatopoeic, really.
Cronk, cronk.
Aye, quite. Aye.
Coming back to the eggs themselves and their scientific value, Bob. You've got an essay in the front of this book, Colin, from Des Thompson, which leads us nicely to Des Thompson's dad. Tell me the story behind that, you know, the significance that eggshells had.
Researchers in the 1940s, probably, were noticing that a number of peregrines and sparrowhawks, for example, they were crushing their eggs as they were sitting on them. And there was investigations done at the time, and one of the people who was involved in that was Derek Ratcliffe. And I know he was a friend of Desmond Ellisold Thompson. And I think it was Desmond who suggested to Derek Ratcliffe that he should use museum egg collections and also private egg collections to derive an index of eggshell thickness from the weights and the dimensions of the eggs. And this was done, and by plotting the index of eggshell thickness, they noticed that on a particular date, so over a couple of years, that there was a sudden drop in the index for eggshell thickness. And this was tied to the use of DDT and other chemical compounds.
Yeah.
which had an effect on the thinning of the eggshells.
Yeah, that research between Ratcliffe and Nethersole Thompson was in the 1960s. What was it, in the mid-1980s before we actually banned DDT completely for agricultural use in Europe? It's extraordinary. Again, I'm just, while we're speaking, just leafing through this book, the dotterel egg, it's against like Japanese art.
Well, hand-painted. When I was photographing them, they are works of art, individual works of art. They're quite remarkable, each one. And that golden eagle's egg, what an eagle's egg that is.
What an eagle's egg.
You become something of a connoisseur of eggs now. I mean, that's an egg.
If you look at the bottom of it, yes, it almost looks like feathers.
It does. It looks like it's that. It looks like it's breast.
It's really exquisite. Absolutely exquisite. And that's why I thought we've got to have that egg big on the opening chapter.
No, it is just extraordinary. And being able to match up those colours, you know, for the bullfinch, and that's Glenshira and Inverary. These are just glorious. Where does this pigment come from in the eggs? You rightly pointed out these blackbird, the clutches of blackbird eggs in front of us range from what I would describe as, you know, sort of robin's egg blue to, you know, right the way to sort of pink. It's an extraordinary variety of things there, but what is the pigment?
There's two main pigments which are in the oviduct, and they're released as the eggshells being formed.
And can that influence how the eggs are marked?
Yes. And also whether the eggs rotate or if they're moved in the oviduct as well, or whether they just sit there.
So if they just sit there, you'd get spots. And if they move, you get lines. And if they're straight, and if they twisted,
You get squiggles.
And why are some, because I noticed this, it's really clear in the book, if you look at things like owls or swan or something like that, the eggs are pure white.
Generally speaking, whole nesting birds would not require any pigments on them if they're in a dark hole.
So something like an owl, there's no need for camouflage, there's no need for the eggs to be cryptic, is that what you're saying?
Generally speaking, that's correct, yeah.
The other thing that fascinates me is the variety of shapes, because you get something that's a traditional egg-shaped column, but, you know, some of them are pointed at both ends, some of them are damn near circular.
That's also one of the appeals of birds' eggs, it's the diversity of shape. And some, as you're looking at in the toniel, I mean, I think these eggs...
It's like
the
moon.
It is. They're almost circular. I mean, that is... I mean, and I've selected one, but in general, toniel's eggs are really circular. But others, like the guillemot's eggs, you've got that, you know, pyroform egg shape. And
it's designed basically to roll round on a ledge, so it shouldn't roll off. It should just rotate round on the ledge and come back to a stopping point.
There's been lots of papers written about that. By,
am I talking rubbish? He's nodding.
Tim Burkhead's done quite a lot of work with that. He wrote a book called The Most Perfect Thing about 3 or 4 years ago, and that was one of the questions he asked himself, and he explores it within the book. I think one of the most important things for guillemots, which are cliff nesting birds, as you know, the sheer densities of them on the cliffs, and that's why there's such a diversity of eggs on guillemots, because they've got to be able to recognise their own egg very, very quickly, you know, because they're going to be inches away from another bird, so they've got to very, very quickly know what egg is theirs. And that's why I think guillemots have got the widest diversity of egg colour, shape. Well, the shapes are the same, but the patterns and the colours are widely diverse.
Was this just a case of you've got six sparrowhawk eggs here? No, I can't even pick one. I'm taking all six.
I think it's in part the reason that sparrowhawks' eggs were so popular to be collected, because you can see the diversity within a clutch, six eggs, and there's not one of them that look the same as the other. That was a very good example of a clutch with six, because, you know, sparrowhawks tend to be four or five, and six is quite a big clutch, but they're quite exquisite, these six eggs.
Yeah. And again, I've just turned the page, and on the right-hand side, beautiful oak tree covered in moss, Ardnamurchan. On the left-hand side, again, it's hawfinch.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when they carve out glass from behind, you know, and you get different thicknesses of colour, if you've got, you know, and it's like that. You know, there's different depths of colour. Your eye gets drawn into the egg. So are people still collecting eggs?
No, not really. I mean, there may be one or two private.
Is that not a loss scientifically if they're not collecting it?
Well, there is a gap, certainly. It has been pointed out that over the last sort of 40 or 50 years that there's not the same amount of material from recent decades in museums now, and that so that is a loss for the scientific integrity of the collections. We do still get eggs that are collected under licence and perhaps the odd confiscated collection, but these are fewer in number now as well. But the raptor monitoring groups, for example, they collect dud eggs, infertile eggs, and we acquire these every year.
Yeah. Just in terms of the egg collection and the fact that the public perception of it is not generally positive, I smiled, when the section that you wrote at the front of this book, when you were talking about, there's probably 5 million eggs worldwide, but UK cats take 50 million birds in a year. So although egg collecting, legal or illegal, is a form of predation, it's minor in comparison with the other problems.
Well, yes, in my opinion, I think that tells a story.
In terms of things like climate change, what can they tell us?
Perhaps the most obvious thing is that birds used to breed in places that they no longer breed. In fact, one of the cards that I have here, the collector has obviously noted on it that there's the locality, it was Edenside Nursery, and then he's obviously added later on, built over in 1967. So that's a clear example where birds used to breed in that particular locality, and it's now been built up. I mean, I think everyone's aware of areas. If you think back to people's childhood and things, open areas near your house, and many of these that I can think of from my childhood, I mean, they're all built over now as well. These places just don't exist anymore.
The bird numbers, certainly compared with the birds that were around when I was a child, aren't there. I mean, if you look at common species like song thrush,
lapwing,
moorhen, kestrel, skylarks. I go back to the farmland that I'd spent my childhood in, and these birds are completely absent. And there are notably one or two birds that weren't there when I was a child. Buzzards would be one. And also goldfinch. Goldfinch seem to have increased in numbers, certainly in Scotland. It comes down to more efficient farming methodology. I mean, you'll have come across this on many occasions. Habitat loss, whether it's road building or retail park building or house building. House building's one of the biggest deterrents for sustaining bird populations. And it just happens bit by bit. I mean, the number of rookeries that I've seen vanish across Scotland in my lifetime is alarming. And it's because there are new housing developments close to where these rookeries were, and they're very shy birds, and they vanish.
It's a fascinating book. This is a fascinating place, Bob. I mean, I'm very keen to actually come in here and have a look around. It is a pity that, you can't display this publicly, but effectively they're like watercolour paintings.
They do fade rapidly in natural light, yes. In fact, sometimes if we get dud golden eagle eggs that have been lying in the nest until the eggs are picked up, usually the top half is bleached and it's only the bottom half that will have the patterns on them.
Yeah. This is a bit like asking, what is your favourite kid? But you know what I'm going to ask? Of all the collection you've got,
I think it's probably the two clutches from around about 1790. I think the fact that these were collected and that they've lasted for over 200 years, I think that's quite impressive.
Clutches all?
One's raven and the other is a common buzzard.
There are a lot of eggs here in the museum which are used for scientific research, but I just kind of feel in a way that I've breathed new life into them, because I'm posting some of these images onto Instagram, and on a daily basis, there's thousands of people looking at these eggs that have been unseen. That beauty is not seen. And, as Bob said, you can't put them out in public display because they'll fade. So the only way to see them really is to photograph them in the manner in which I've done, using stacking. I'm sure if these collectors were still around now, they would really want to have the eggs photographed in the same manner, because they could see them on a 5K screen now, and it would be far easier and more enjoyable to look at the the images on a 5K screen that's backlit than some dimly, you know, lit Georgian house with some cigar smoke blowing on it. So that is the way that I think people can enjoy these.
It's breathed new life into the eggs and it's breathed new life into you too.
Indeed. And I need as much of that as I can get, Mark, believe me.
Join the queue, get to the back.
Thanks very much there to Colin Pryor and Bob McGowan of the National Museums of Scotland. Colin's beautiful book, Fragile, is out now. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd like to recommend a series made by our colleagues here at BBC Radio Scotland. It's called A Doorstep Murder and follows the investigation into the murder of Alistair Wilson. It's one of Scotland's most baffling unsolved cases. A new episode's just been uploaded featuring an interview with Alistair's sons, Andrew, who speaks publicly for the first time. That's A Doorstep Murder, presented by Fiona Walker, available on BBC Sounds. Any thoughts on anything we do, please get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We love hearing from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From all of the team in BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.